Welcome to the Daily Briefing. I'm your host, Jack Varley. It's Monday, December 21st. I'm going to be joined shortly by Peter Buchvar from Bleakley Advisory Group. But first, with the day's stories, Haley Drasnan.
Hey, Jack. Markets wavered Monday as a new strain of the coronavirus emerged in England and prompted fresh travel restrictions across Europe. The worsening cases served as a wake-up call after enthusiasm about COVID-19 vaccines has pushed stocks to record highs in recent weeks. The Dow did inch higher Monday afternoon, but the NASDAQ and the S&P 500 were both down. Oil producers, airlines, and cruise lines were all hit by the resurgence of COVID-19 fears. Shares of Tesla even fell in their S&P 500 debut on Monday. 10 of the S&P 500's 11 sectors were actually in negative territory on Monday. The only sector to post gains was financials, which got a boost after the Fed said on Friday that it would allow banks to resume share buybacks. Some investors saw today's markets as a buying opportunity, also because of the big support around the $900 billion stimulus bill that's expected to pass in Congress on Monday. Americans could start receiving checks as early as next week. That's direct payments of $600 to most Americans and $300 per week for those enhanced unemployment benefits. It also includes $284 billion for the Paycheck Protection Program, which provides those forgivable loans to small businesses, and more money too for airlines, vaccine distribution, schools, universities, food aid, and many other provisions. The package can help prevent a double dip recession and boost GDP. It forestalls a double dip recession, almost, some would say. Investors may also be seeking to lock in profits from this news with only just two trading weeks left in 2020. The S&P 500 is up more than 13% for the year, while the Dow has risen about 5% and the NASDAQ has rallied more than 40% this year as investors favor those high growth tech companies. It is important to note that many of the stimulus protections will expire in the first quarter, so additional relief could be needed by March, and this will be under the Biden administration. While the COVID-19 vaccine rollout is expected to pick up by the spring, the sectors most impacted by the pandemic are unlikely to approach full reopening until later in the year. I'll let Jack and Peter dive into all of that more. But just on a personal note, ahead of the holidays, I want to thank all of you for tuning into RVDB. You've all been supportive of my journey on camera here since I started this summer, and I read your comments and continue to work on improving in my content and delivery. So I wish all of you and your families well this holiday season. Thanks again, and here's Jack.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Thanks, Haley. Welcome, Peter.
Thanks, Jack, for having me.
Of course, as always. So, Peter, it's one of the busiest news days of this year. We've had, you know, Tesla is the first time trading in the S&P 500. There was recently discovered a new strain of COVID in the United Kingdom. The stimulus bill, it's announced that it will be passed. The vote on that will be passed, you know, shortly after this interview films. What do you make of this day of intense and abundant news flow?
Well, for sure, the news out of the UK was the main focus. I consulted with Dr. Google over the weekend when I started reading about this these extra mutations, but supposedly viruses always mutate. So I think that there's, as the day progressed, in the U.S., maybe a growing relief that the existing vaccines will be able to address a lot of these mutations. So I think that is sort of bringing the theme that has been in place for a while, particularly since November 9th when Pfizer came out with their news that we're looking past COVID and we're not going to certainly, I don't want to say obsess because there's obviously terrible health consequences to this, but from a business perspective, trying to look particularly those companies that are going to benefit tremendously from the other side.
Right. So how would you say the market is evaluating the risk of COVID-19? And how are you evaluating that risk as we move into 2021?
Well, the markets are again, looking to the vaccine and everything that all the benefits that come with it. If you look at the stocks that have been hammered the most this year because of COVID, well, they've had a sharp rebound since November 9th. I've looked at this year as sort of a tale of two markets, pre-November 9th mm-hmm. and post-March 23rd. You had tech and the work-from-home beneficiaries, and then you had everything else. And that everything else have certainly benefited since November 9th, where tech in some areas have taken a breather and other areas have continued to explode higher. But at least from a market perspective and the indices, it's looking to the other side. And all I have to do is look to understand what the market is focused on. And that is a world with a vaccine and post-COVID and not one without a vaccine in the middle of COVID. Now, of course, there's a huge swath of the U.S. economy, small businesses, those in leisure and hospitality that will suffer, unfortunately, for the next couple of months with many not coming out of it. But when looking at the market, we're obviously dealing with bigger companies that have access to the capital markets that will have a better chance of making it through.
Right. Peter, I want to know what your outlook is on this growth versus value trade for 2021. As you said, since November 9th, we've had a big rotation away from those high-flying growth stocks into the more beaten down sectors, you know, the industrials, the cruise liners, the airliners, the energy companies, commercial real estate, I might add. What's your outlook on those assets for the new year?
Well, I'm in the belief in the inflation campaign that it is not only coming, but it's here and is only going to increase as the next year or two progresses. And I'm not talking about going from 1.5% to 2% to maybe 2.25%, 2.5% inflation. I'm talking about 3/10, 4/10 monthly CPI increases, and that we're going to see 3, 4, potentially 5% year-over-year increases in inflation. Now, granted, part of that is an easy comparison because you're comping it against a COVID world. But I think even if you normalize it, you're still going to see a surprise to the upside, which means that'll be the bond market, the long end of the bond market, that will be tightening rates for the Fed because we know they're going to overstay their welcome and keep rates at zero for forever, it seems. And that this is going to lead to a compression of multiples for these fast-growing companies that are great companies. But I think that there'll just be a rethink in what to pay for them. So the value side has embedded in them low expectations. So I think investors will focus more on benefit they derive from a better economy and will be least impacted by what I think is a compression in multiples. So I guess bottom line to 2021 is trying to figure out what that right PE multiple is. Because I think that the economy is not going to have a sharp rebound with a vaccine and the 10-year yield there. I'm expecting a 10-year yield that's going to go to 1.5% to 2% next year because it'll be the long end of the curve that tightens for the Fed in response to faster growth and what I foresee is much higher inflation. So what's the right multiple to pay on that? Right now, we're trading at 22 times 21 earnings and 18 plus on 22. And if I'm right on inflation, if I'm right on long rates, I would think that that multiple likely compresses. Now, there's also a huge swath of the market, not just in the U.S., but overseas, that are trading at lower multiples that I think will be more immune and have the potential of outperforming. So I'm really more calling out the mega valuations of stocks that are trading at 30, 40 times sales or even 100 to plus to 200 times sales. And people have to understand that, again, a compression of a multiple with no change in earnings could be a big influence on the direction of that stock.
Right. Just to explain, Peter, your thesis to some of the folks at home, You're thinking that the price to earnings ratio, which is the price of the stock relative to the earnings per share, or the price of that, how much it's worth in market cap relative to its net income, you think that that is going to decrease, and that as inflation picks up, investors are going to anticipate that inflation, and on their long bonds, their 20-year, 30-year treasuries, they're going to sell those off, and lead, which will increase the yield. Is that what you're saying, pretty much?
Well, it'll specifically in the bond market, if I'm right, you start to see the monthly prints of 3, 4, 5 tenths, which I know some people are going to watch this and think that I'm crazy, but I think between a combination of easy comparisons and the rise that we're seeing in goods prices, and part of that commodity prices, and that when you get the economy, hopefully this summer with broad inoculation, that the service side is going to see a rebound in inflation again after seeing some compression in 2020. On the side, we've seen sharp declines in rents in some of the major cities, but with home prices gaining 6, 7, 8% annualized, you're going to see a rebound in rents. So in response to that, the short end will remain pinned by the Fed. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So the long end will be what is going to reflect that higher inflation. In addition to what I see is continued weakness in the dollar, which will import inflation and therefore cause a rethink in the high multiple parts of the market that will see a downdraft in those multiples, even though maybe their businesses continue to do well in 2021. I think what investors are going to pay for that stream of earnings will be lower than they are today.
Right. Okay. So throughout this year, or since April, I should say, we've seen break-evens go ever higher and real rates go lower. So you're telling me that you think that this trend will continue. And you know, I assume that is very bullish for commodities. What's your view on commodities and those, you know, the stocks that trade and in those in commodities?
So I'm having to be very bullish on commodities and commodity stocks. And to be specific, I think energy stocks are setting up for a really nice move higher in the next year or two. Agriculture in particular, I like the fertilizer stocks in that space. Copper, which has already had a nice run, I still think has a lot more to go. I mean, about $350, $360 a pound, I think we're going to see $4.50 a pound. And copper stocks will obviously be a beneficiary from that. And then also precious metals, which are partly a commodity, partly a currency, that I think will see further upside gains. And also, in addition, you can play the commodity currencies like the Aussie dollar, the Canadian dollar, mm-hmm. Brazilian real. I think that after 10 years of U.S. equity market performance, a lot of it having to do with technology relative to the rest of the world, I think we're going to see that depending the other way, particularly emerging Asia and even parts of Europe. Parts of Europe are basically a value stock wasteland for good, for better, for worse, with a lot of financials that I think will benefit from a steeper yield curve from right on inflation and also a better economy and plenty of cheap bank stocks that have essentially been killed by the ECB, but maybe can benefit in the face of that. And also there's, particularly in the UK market, a lot of commodity type names like BP and Royal Dutch and BHP that I think will be a beneficiary from right on the commodity trade.
Right. So you're very bullish on energy. You just listed a few stocks, as well as the fertilizer space. Could you tell us, I'm not very familiar with the fertilizer space. What are some of the biggest players in that market?
Mosaic and Nutrien are the two biggest, at least in the US. But think about what drives the demand for fertilizer. Fertilizer, obviously, a need to basically enhance the productivity of one's land. So if I'm farming soybeans and corn, if all of a sudden, well, I need fertilizers every year, but if corn and soybean prices are low, I have less money to pay for fertilizer, and maybe I skimp on it, which then impacts the yield, which then impacts the prices, which then eventually go up. And then once crop prices start to go up, well, I have more income, I can afford more fertilizer, I can better treat my land. And I think that's what we're beginning to see now. In addition to a lot of supply responses that we've seen in some of these fertilizers have also helped, in Mosaic and Nutrien have literally closed plants, even though we've seen some supply in Saudi Arabia and Morocco and some other places. But I think overall, when it comes to agriculture, as long as the world's population is growing, you can get the global demand for food pretty much right, and it steadily goes up. It's getting this cycle that is sort of the marginal issue when it comes to both crop prices and also on the fertilizer space. And I think that we've seen a nice move in soybean and corn prices of late, and I expect them to head higher, which will then also help the demand for fertilizers.
Thanks, Peter. Just switching gears a little bit, you talked about the assets that you were bullish on, which you expect to increase in value. Where do you expect that liquidity to come from? Do you expect it to come from the FANG names, which are perhaps very, very plump now? Or do you think that it's going to come from the IPO and SPAC model, which are, a lot of people are saying are reminding them of the dot-com era bubble? Where are you seeing the risks in this market?
Well, keep in mind, when it comes to flows, it's, for every buyer, there's a seller. So for every seller of that FANG stock, there is a buyer. So to me, it's going to be more of where people are going to crowd in or crowd out of. And it is a good question. I mean, I think with the energy sector, 2.5% of the S&P, and I don't think it's ever been that low as a percent of that market, all you need to do is get back to 4 to 5, and you have a rather sharp increase in these stocks. And it's not like I'm a long-term bull in crude oil, but I think we've seen over the last couple of years some starvation in the investment in commodities, in pulling. Now, shale obviously had a big 2019, but offshore drilling has had a sharp reduction in the pace of investment. And I think a lot of shale, it may take years before we get back to that 2019 level of production, if ever. And also globally, a lot of projects have been canceled ever since oil prices collapsed back in 2014. I don't think we've had enough silver mines found and copper mines, and that this dollar shift to technology and FANG and all these others have literally deprived the actual mining capital for higher prices. And you combine a vaccine and an improved economy in 2021, 2022, and that is the formula for higher commodity prices.
So that's the formula for higher commodity prices. I guess what I want to know from you, Peter, is what's your outlook on the Snowflakes of the world, the Teslas of the world, the Nikolas, the Neos, other companies, Airbnb, companies like that. I assume, but because you omitted it, you assume it's not something that you are bullish on. But do you see a major risk in those assets for investors?
Well, I'm excited for the fundamentals of a lot of these businesses. I just get a nosebleed when I look at their valuation, and particularly Snowflake, which I have no position in either way. That's trading in, I think, 200 times sales, or maybe 100 times next year sales. And I'm sure it's a great company, and I don't fully understand what they do. But when you get there, there's a lot of room for error, and there are many, 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 many years of growth that you need to have to grow into that valuation. Now, with respect to the overall market, I knew you wanted to touch upon sentiment. I don't know if you want me to sort of segue into that, because this ebullient sentiment is what is helping to inflate a lot of these multiples. And the question is how long that can last.
Absolutely. So you mentioned sentiment, and we should definitely transition to that. There's a chart you sent me, which is the Citigroup Panic Euphoria model. And it's a very interesting chart because it shows how in March we dipped into that panic mode, but now we are much more in euphoria mode than we are in panic mode. What can you tell me about what this chart is saying, and specifically, how is this thing calculated?
Well, I want to start by saying that I don't like to look at one. I like to look at them because I want to see them corroborate each other, because some sentiment gauges measure just how you feel. You bullish, you bearish, you neutral. Others are measuring what is actually taking place by investors, which is reflected in the put-call ratio, advance decline, up volume, down volume, where the VIX is, where credit spreads are, where indexes are relative to their moving averages, to see how extended we are. So there are a multitude of these. So the Citi Panic Euphoria, which I get from Barron's every weekend, they have their own proprietary metric, and that includes a bunch of inputs. And anything above 0.4 is considered euphoric, and everything below, I forgot which is the downside, is a measure of panic. And when it gets into one of those sort of boxes, it is predictive of what the market performance will be over the next 12 months. So right now in the panic euphoria index, the euphoria is at 1.65. That is four times the threshold line where you reach into euphoria, 0.41. So that's how extended you are. And that is actually above where you were in the late 1990s and early 2000. So now it can stay there for sure, but according to Citi, it's highly predictive of a down market 12 months from now. Now you combine that with investors' intelligence, where there's almost a 50-point spread between the bulls and the bears, with the bull side in particular well above 60. That's considered extreme. You have in the AAII measure of individual investors, where bulls are well above bears, you have the Citi Fear Greed Index that reached 90 a couple of weeks ago. It's come off that, but also showing extreme bullishness. You have pull-call ratios that are very low. So you put all this together, and it tells you that a lot of good news that we're seeing right now with the vaccine and another spending package and a Fed that is seemingly going to be easy forever has been reflected in prices. And you know, one thing I wrote about today is that when you have this level of ebullience, that sometimes a punch comes out of nowhere and knocks you for a loop. And you don't know where that punch is going to come from, but sometimes it does. And a market that is that elevated with respect to sentiment is not necessarily best able to handle it. And I think the vaccine will get us past this new mutation. But I think, again, there's no room for error when you have this kind of euphoria.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
You mentioned the taking away the punch bowl. To just run with your metaphor a little bit, last week the Fed had their FOMC meeting, and they certainly did not take away the punch bowl. They have a lot of their programs are still running, but one could argue that they didn't necessarily add more punch either. What did you make of that? Number one, with the Fed, and then two, what do you make of the Fed's expiring emergency lending programs on December 31st, which are sort of now being used as a political bargaining chip during the stimulus talks?
Well, that punch bowl is pretty spiked right now. I don't think, and we have a vaccine, so the Fed would have looked silly to increase their QE program now that we have a vaccine. In fact, I've argued that they need to stop looking at what's right in front of their face and understand that they are so far in this punch bowl that now with the vaccine, instead of thinking about what more they can do, they should be thinking about how the heck are they going to get out of this. Right now, Fed policy is a COVID world of 2020. They, now that we're heading into 2021 with a vaccine, they should really be thinking about how do they start removing some of this accommodation, not continuing it on. But that's the Fed mentality. It's asymmetric policy that they dive headfirst into easing and they crawl their way into tightening. But as I argued earlier, it'll be the bond market that'll end up being the final arbiter on Fed policy, on whether they're too easy, they're too tight, or they're just right. And I think it's easy to say that they're obviously going to be way too easy in 2021 because their policy is just not really correlate well with a dramatically improving economy, which I think we're going to see with a vaccine. So with respect to these Fed programs that Pat Toomey was instrumental in having them expire, well, they should expire. They were implemented in March 2020 when the world looked like a very different place than they do today. And I'm not a fan of the Fed doing this mission creep. And every single time we get a crisis, it creates some new program that then never goes away. And that was clearly the case. So if Congress wants to come back, well, they can bring it back. But to give the Fed just this blank check that is just totally open-ended, I'm glad we put some of these things to bed, particularly the purchasing of corporate bonds, which I think is a road they never should have gone down.
Yeah, Peter, your point about mission creep is well taken. We take these steps and, you know, sooner rather than later, we end up like Japan, where the quantitative easing involves actually buying equities. On the other hand, just to play devil's advocate, one could say that the emergency programs that we had this year were not needed because, you know, shortly after March and into mid-April, we were into the euphoria phase and out of the panic phase. What happens if we enter a panic phase again? I know that's not your case, but what happens if we do and we don't have those emergency lending programs? Could that be something that's very negative for stocks and the economy?
Well, from a market perspective, markets left to their own can readjust. And yeah, we saw a disappearance of bids back in March, particularly in the Treasury market. Mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. I blame a lot of that to Dodd-Frank and this Volcker rule. If we didn't have the Volcker rule and we had banks that were able to take on inventory, we put the rotations in markets. So dislocations in individual stocks, but buyers come in and it fixes the market. So the Fed needs to show a little humility, let free markets work a little bit, and understand that there's a huge pool of money that is there that wants to take advantage of down markets, that there's a whole pool of money of distressed money that wants to take advantage of declines in prices. But, you know, the Fed doesn't have this faith in the regenerative ability of free markets, unfortunately. So everyone thinks that God forbid, the Fed's not there, disaster happens. And that is not only the case when it comes to markets. Now, when it comes to the economy and their influence, well, that's a whole different argument. But this idea that the Fed had to print trillions of dollars to fix market functioning, in fact, it actually leads to market dysfunction. The Fed has now made markets dysfunctional because everyone now relies on that. So the Bank of Japan has completely broken the JGB market. Some days it doesn't even trade. And it's on its path to breaking the ETF market through their purchases. So this just total nonsense that we need the Fed for market functioning. And again, they lead to more market dysfunction than function.
You make a very good argument. Peter, switching gears just a little bit, I know you are somewhat bearish on the dollar because of your views on inflation. And, you know, sort of taking to that extreme, some are saying that the dollar will cease to be a global reserve asset and will sort of evolve to a multipolar currency world. My question to you is, let's say China no longer wants to own treasuries as they you know have stopped buying over the past few years. I should say they have slowed down their pace of buying. You know, what is the global sovereign asset of choice? You know, it's probably not European assets with their negative yields. You know, what you just mentioned the problems in the Japanese government bond market. You know, is it true, like in the same way that it's true of stocks? You know, there's no alternative. It has all these problems of overvaluation, but just Tina, there is no alternative. You know, what are you seeing in terms of what could be an alternative to the dollar?
Well, I think for a while to come, it's still going to be the reserve currency, but it may just be less influential. And that is, the years progress, there'll be more transactions that take place in things other than the dollar. And when I look at the dollar, it's not just the inflation that I foresee. Because this year, we certainly saw a lot of dollar weakness and very little inflation, even though we have more inflation today than we did a year ago, not this deflation that I hear about. But the rising debts and deficits in the U.S. is dollar negative. And you can draw a 30-year chart of the U.S. dollar on the budget deficit as a percent of GDP, and they pretty much follow. So I don't see any real end to these exploding debts and deficits. I mean, Congress is about to pass a $900 billion spending plan is going to last 3 months. 3 months, that's how long this $900 billion is going to last, essentially. So to me, that is the real anchor on the dollar, in addition to the large current account deficit that always seems to widen. And then I think, again, on inflation. So there's a combination of things that are going to lead to a weaker dollar. Now, I acknowledge that this has now become conventional thinking, and we're going to see some bouts of dollar squeezes to the upside. But I think people will be not surprised at dollar weakness. I think they'll be surprised at the extent of the dollar weakness.
Mm.
You know, that's very you can apply to what you asked. I mean, there's the dollar's still going to be reserve currency, but as I said, things that will more compete, but you're not going to take away that reserve currency status for a while to come.
Mm, Peter, that's a very interesting point. I love talking macro and hearing your macro analysis, and you know, I'd love to have you back and do more macroeconomic analysis. But something in addition to your bird's eye view analysis, Peter, you're known for your analysis of specific stocks. So before we jumped on this call, we were talking a little bit about specific stocks. You know, you mentioned Live Nation Entertainment as something that you would have seen value in it, but it's just, you know, it's trading at practically March levels. But then you also mentioned some other stocks where you did see some opportunity. So can you just give me and any of the people at home just a broad sense of, you know, specific stocks that you're looking at?
There are cheap stocks out there. It's not just your only choice is not the big cap tech stocks that we all know about and the high valued software names. Two that I happen to like is CVS and Walgreens that have single digit PE ratios. Good dividend yields. There's this belief that Amazon's going to kill them both. And I couldn't disagree more. I think that one thing that both companies are establishing are these neighborhood healthcare destinations, where CVS has the Meta clinics that have these nurse practitioners that if you have a sore throat or you want a flu shot or you think you got COVID, you can go get tested. And Walgreens has an agreement with VillageMD where they're literally going to be putting doctor's offices next to a Walgreens. So you can go to the doctor and you can walk across the hall and get your prescription. And both companies have well-established wholesale businesses, pharmacy benefit management, businesses and relationships that they're going to compete just fine with Amazon.
In the other equities, other assets within the value universe, commercial real estate, airlines, cruise lines, you know, what are your thoughts on those sort of business models?
I actually think that, well, I'm bullish on leisure and hospitality in 2021, 2022. I think the desire to travel from a leisure perspective, not necessarily business, is a mega trend, particularly a mega trend with baby boomers, a mega trend with a growing middle class, particularly in Asia. Now, that said, you take the cruise line stocks, the airlines, they've taken on a lot of debt. They sold a lot of equity. So that equity is worth less than it was pre-COVID. So you have to acknowledge that. But certainly travel-related names in Asia, airport stocks throughout the world that have gotten hammered, I think are going to come back pretty nicely. That is not going to change. The desire to travel has only been temporarily impacted.
Mm. Peter, I think that the view that you just expressed, that the desire to travel has only been temporarily...
That the
leisure travel has only been temporarily halted rather than structurally impaired over the long term. That's somewhat of a contrarian view. You know, there are people who are saying that travel for a long time is not going to recover. Do you have any other views that I hesitate to use the word contrarian, but do you have any other views that perhaps the market has that are predominant and prevailing views in the market that you believe to be incorrect?
So let's take office real estate, for example. The consensus is work from home and Zoom and who needs to go to work and who needs all this space. Now, certainly in San Francisco and New York and LA, where there's people leaving, so there's population exodus, that I get, that you're going to have extra supply. Landlords are not necessarily going to have pricing power. But office buildings in North Carolina and Charlotte, in Atlanta, Georgia, in Austin, Texas, in Houston, in Phoenix, in Miami, these are the places that people are moving to. And I really believe that people do want to get back to their desk and their office. They want to commingle with their coworkers. And maybe many people are not going to go to work 5 days a week. They're still going to go to work maybe 4 days a week because they want to, but also because their employers want them to. So to me, real estate in parts of the market that are seeing population and income growth and employment growth, to me, that's actually a pretty attractive area when you look out over the next 5 years. And to me, most people think everyone's working from home, and I just don't see it after we get this vaccine out there.
Mm. So I, in the background, have the beach. So I clearly am not, I am working from home. I'm not going to the office. But Peter, where can you tell us where you are right now?
So I'm just in a suburban office space in New Jersey. So I've actually been coming here since Memorial Day. It's only three stories I get to walk up, so I don't have to deal with commuting into the city. I don't have to deal with getting on an elevator. So at least in the tri-state area, the suburban office space, I think will definitely outperform New York City for those people that don't really want to commute and get on a train and spend an hour and a half each way getting to their office. But if you can drive a half hour to your office in Charlotte, that's a much more attractive way of your work-life balance.
Mm, excellent. So when you mentioned commercial real estate in New York City, a ticker that came to mind was SL Green, that I believe Jim Chanos talked to Mike Green about in an interview last month. In the non-San Francisco, non-New York commercial real estate space, Peter, is there any way you could give us and the audience at home a ticker of something that you like?
I'll give one name, Cousins Properties. Owns office buildings in some very attractive demographic parts of the country.
Wonderful. Well, Peter, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed our conversation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jack. I appreciate having me on.
Of course, anytime.